So I want to continue with spins. What I want to do today is put this into the context of quantum computing, and we'll use the rubric that David DiVincenzo came up with last century for what you need for a quantum computer, which isn't really what you need for a quantum computer, but it's a nice way of organizing. We'll talk about that. But let's recall. So we're looking at spins, and in fact, so far we've looked at spin 1/2, and if we're left looking at the expectation value, then we can write down a set of equations that Bloch originally wrote down. And we'll write them down in the rotating frame. And that there was a precession term, we saw that we could introduce a Rabi frequency and there was a relaxation term. And since we've taken the energy axis to be along z, they're different. And of course, there's a term that returns the system to thermal equilibrium. We went through a series of experiments to say, how would we characterize this? Looking at Rabi, Ramsey, in a variety of echoes, and particularly looking at the echoes where we have some distribution of frequencies. And we saw two things with that. One, of course, we saw that if this distribution of frequencies was static, then we could perfectly refocus it. And then we saw that actually, if it's dynamic, we could refocus it too. And our ability to refocus it depends upon exactly what that structure is, and it depends also on how fast we can modulate the system. I want to come back to that in just a second. And then I told you that that these were correct in the limit that we had a weak measurement, so that the measurement didn't modify the system at all. And of course, that allowed us to make a continuous measurement with the Ramsey, right? That the original Ramsey was to measure step by step with a projective measurement. But because we have a weak measurement and we're measuring things that are inductively coupled, then we could measure continuously. But there's always a price to pay. Nothing's perfectly weak. And I didn't write down this, but I will now. So if I write down the nonlinearities associated with a weak measurement, then you can see that we get the term that's going to take us. So clearly a nonlinear term, I mean, m sub 0 is just a constant, right? And it's going to take us always back towards the z-axis. And it won't matter where we are in the transverse plane, it will always take us back to the z-axis. And this time constant, t sub r, the rate at which we get back to that axis, depends upon the quality factor of the coil. Remember that the quality factor of a circuit is when you push it, how long does it keep swinging? And the eta just says, what's your efficiency of detecting those spins? And so, you know, the higher the gyromagnetic ratio, so the bigger the moment, the more spins you have, the higher the Q, all of those things are going to make for a shorter time.
Okay.
And that's, of course, easy to see. Now, we also looked at running a sequence of pulses to refocus. It's nice to write it in this way. Where we get an echo here. And this is the so-called, so a series of pi pulses. It's a so-called Karpfer-Cell sequence. And it's nice to write it this way, because if you ran this sequence, you would find that although you get an echo at this point too, right? There's a pi pulse split by an equal time. That this echo here, after two pi pulses, is more robust. And if you go back to the moment expansion that we put at the board at the very end of last class, remember that if I looked at the k-space trajectory, right, it would go up, it would come down, there would be an echo. And so this piece looks like we've got the second binomial term, not the first one. And so if I look at this echo, we would refocus the location of the spin. But if I look at this echo, I not only refocus the location of the spin, but I also refocus any slow changes in the frequency that the spin sees. And so, and you'll remember, I hope, that if we were looking at that moment expansion, the first two gradient moments that we applied looked like this. So that looks like one pi pulse in this. This looks like two pi pulses. And so this echo is more robust than that one, which is why we write it this way. Yeah? Okay. Now, it's also nice to show you one more thing. There's there's a very nice result in quantum information that says, in quantum control, I guess, that if I have a static variation in a Hamiltonian, then I can create a unitary which is perfectly independent of that static variation. And Herschel Roberts formalized this best, but it's been known for a long time. And an early example was given by Maiboon and Gill. He said, if you take the Karpfer-Cell sequence, and instead of giving an X pulse, you give a Y pulse, that this sequence is robust to errors in the pi pulse. And that all you had to do was change that. And it's a little bit nice just to look at this in terms of, let me make this the x-axis and not the y-axis. In terms of the way the magnetization vectors flow. So we start off with our magnetization along z. We give a y pulse. The y pulse will place us along x. And so we have our magnetization sitting here at this point. And then, of course, what's it going to do? It'll see a variety of different frequencies, delta, omega, and so it'll rotate from there, but it's rotating about the z-axis. And so it will rotate in some direction in the xy plane. It'll be in the xy plane. And so let's say that it goes here. If I give a rotation, I'm going to rotate about this axis now. And so I'll rotate over here somewhere. And so you can imagine, well, what would happen if the angle is less than pi or greater than pi? I would be above the xy axis or I'd be below the xy axis, right? So if I'm rotating exactly by pi, I'll end up back in the xy plane. Anything else, I'll be above or below. And during this time, well, it's going to process in exactly the same direction it did there, right? We're refocusing slow variations. And so if it's above, it's still above. If it's below, it's still below. And this pulse, the error will very nicely take us back exactly into the transverse plane. And so if I looked along this axis, there's my xy plane. This is x. The first evolution will take us in this direction. A pulse would take us over here. We would go back in this direction, and the next pulse would take us back to the axis. And so you'd see that we wouldn't be accumulating errors, whereas in this case, you're always accumulating the errors of the pulse. I'll leave that for you to figure out. But small errors, small static errors, we can always find a way of removing them from the dynamics. And I've given you a notebook to look at a really simple example of this, that if I want to take mz to minus mz, then we could say, well, let me do that by having a pi pulse about the x-axis, say. So now then I would rotate but if there's an error, if it's not quite pi, and of course remember that to get this pulse we had to precisely set the times and the amplitudes, and there's always going to be an error. Even if you say there isn't always going to be an error, your time base has some finite resolution, your amplifier has some noise, there's always going to be an error. And then I can say, well, okay, instead of doing this, let me give a pi over 2 rotation about x, a pi rotation about y, followed by a pi over 2 rotation about x. I'm going to make that minus y just to make the drawing a little bit easier. And then you say, well, okay, what would happen is if the angle that we've selected is small, is shorter than pi, well, then this angle would be shorter as well, and so we would end up not quite reaching the y-axis. We give a 180-degree rotation about that, which would be not quite a 180-degree rotation, but be closer. And then we would continue, and we would end up closer to the minus z-axis. And so you can build these composite pulses that if I add an error here, you will get more robust and closer to the right answer. And you can make these as arbitrarily precise as you like. Okay. Good. Now let's get back. Or let's start with David DiVincenzo's. So back in the mid to late 90s, you couldn't pick up a copy of Physics Review Letters without having a few proposals for a quantum computer in the issue. And there were a lot of good ideas. There were even more crazy ideas. And so the community needed a set of saying, well, this is the bare minimum you would need if you're going to call your thing a quantum computer. And many people came up with these, but the ones that stuck are from David DiVincenzo, who was then at IBM. He's at Aachen now. So the first thing is that you had to have a scalable mapping of your physical system into qubits. And later, it became clear that a tensor product structure is even better. You know, there's an awful lot we don't know about quantum computing. So, you know, if you want to say, well, prove to me that you can't do it, many things we can't prove yet. But if we, for instance, have a unary system, so you have a set of ladder states, you want to make a harmonic oscillator into a quantum computer, and you say, well, I'll just assign levels, separations to be qubits, that you can't do. Okay, so that's been proven. But a lot of things haven't been. But the tensor product structure is lovely.
So how are these two different then?
What's that?
So how are these two different then? The concept of scalability and the concept of having a tensor product structure.
So scalability may be broader than having a tensor product structure. So, you know, tensor product structure is a nice feature, but actually, it's not shown that that is a requirement. You know, there isn't something I can point to that says, "Oh, it doesn't have a tensor product structure, and is still scalable," right? Okay. So we need to initialize. Therefore, you want to, and in David's original statement, he said that he wanted to be able to come arbitrarily close to a pure state. And that's not necessary. As long as you come close enough, then there's algorithmic cooling approaches to taking and purifying a state. So you don't need to become, you don't need arbitrarily close to a pure state. And of course, there's some protocols, the power of one qubit, that don't rely upon purity at all. That you can do some things, at least, that are beyond classical computation without having any purity in your system. And all you need to do is to have a qubit and to be able to control it. And that qubit does not need to be pure. And if your interest is solving the Jones polynomial, for instance, you can do it that way. If your interest is quantum error correction, you're bloody out of luck. You need gates, and you need the gates to be faster than they decohere. And since then, so I should put algorithmic cooling here. Since then, there have been a number of threshold results. And the thresholds say, if your noise is of this structure, and if quantum resources don't cost you, then you can suppress errors. And to have, you know, the structure of noise that we can prove thresholds is really quite limiting. But the benefit to the thresholds is we can say, yes, we have examples where we know we can control errors. And so that's an important piece. And you might know that in the mid-90s, just before 1996, which was a good year for quantum computing, the Jasons had a really thick report of what you could do with a quantum computer. And their answer was you couldn't, that it was non-physical, you couldn't build one. Big, thick, red book. And their argument was basically that since you can't clone, you can't do error correction, therefore quantum computing doesn't work. And you know what the other 2,000 pages were necessary for, I don't know. but that was their argument, and then of course Steen and Shor demonstrated that, in fact, you don't have to copy to do error correction. You need to correlate. And so, yeah. A universal gate set. That was originally thought to be a big deal, but that is probably the most trivial of all these things. And a qubit-specific measurement. So there's two ideas. One, that out of your processor, you can selectively measure one qubit. So you can say precisely what qubit, and you can measure it. And the second is whether or not you need projective measurement. And projective measurement, in many ways, is nice, right? It allows you to initialize. In terms of applying quantum error correction, whereas it was thought to be necessary, it is, in fact, not necessary to have projective measurement. We still don't know how things fully scale as things get bad. But OK, so these are the requirements. And now let's take. Let's take NMR, and knowing full well that liquid state NMR isn't going to fulfill these, we're going to go through and see, you know, what it does work, what it does allow, what it doesn't allow, and then in a couple days, I'll show you that with some small modifications, you can have a scalable system. So now I need to start with a Hamiltonian that's richer than one qubit. And so we'll look at this Hamiltonian. So now I imagine that I have a molecule and it contains k spins. And this frequency, of course, contains the Zeeman frequency, but it also contains the chemical shift. And the chemical shift is the one that we care about. So what happens now is that we have some spin. I'll do it over here. So if we look at ethanol, so in ethanol, we have three distinct types of protons, and the bonding of these are quite different. And so what happens is that the chemical shifts of these are very different. And I should have drawn it, well, it doesn't matter. So if I looked at this, I would see three resonances in a ratio of 3 to 2 to 1. If you were looking at them on an NMR spectrometer, the spectrum would go the other way, but who cares? And whereas the Zeeman term is hundreds of megahertz, the chemical shift is 10 kilohertz. Could be tens of kilohertz, could be less than that. This term is the scalar coupling. And it's due to a Fermi contact mechanism. So what happens is you have electrons in a molecular orbital that are interacting with two atoms. The nuclear spin has this, the nucleus has spin. So therefore, there's an interaction between the nuclear spin and the electron cloud. And then the electron cloud mediates that interaction with the next nuclear spin. And so there's a coupling that is a contact term. It depends upon the electron density. And you recall that the only orbital which has an overlap with the nucleus is an S orbital. Every other orbital has a node there. And so pretty much the scalar coupling comes in as measuring the S character of a molecular orbital. And so you have sp3 hybridization here, right? And so there's S character to those. And so what this is it says, well, there's a coupling between those. And therefore, if I had this proton, well, it will see a coupling to those two protons. And therefore, this, if I look carefully in it, it will have three peaks separated by a frequency. And the reason three, of course, is that there's one way for those two protons to be both up, one way for them to be both down, and there's two ways for to have one up and one down. And this separation here is some hertz. Can be as high as hundreds of hertz, depending upon the chemistry. Now, of course, this one, this proton is split because of this one. and it's split into one. Etc. 1 to 3 to 3 to 1, right? And this splitting is exactly the same as that. It turns out that if you remember your chemistry in ethanol, that the OH proton is acidic. And so it's not going to hang around. So it comes on and off, right? That's what we mean by acidic. And so if I have this proton coming and going, and I know that the equilibrium magnetization of the nuclear spin is close to being 50-50, that on average, as it comes back, it'll have changed spin state. And so because it's coming on and off and on and off and changing spin state, then we don't see it here, because it will effectively decouple itself. Very much like the Carpuccell sequence, that it's going to be changing the state quickly, and therefore the average is zero. Okay, good. So, I'm going to skip a little bit. So here we can say, oh yes, we certainly have a tensor product structure. It's a little bit nicer if I don't have three, if I just have one of each, but it makes no real difference. And the tensor structure, there's a question of, well, is it a scalable tensor structure? Well, not if I choose a molecule, right? The molecule has a particular size, and that's all you get. And the chemical shift range is fixed. So let's say that I want to apply a gate that rotates the A spin. And let's just take that we have only two spins. A and B. And just to give ourselves something really concrete, let's start with them both lined along the z-axis. So then I would have A, B, Z, X, and Y. But I only want to rotate, I want to put the A spin into a coherent superposition of up and down. I want to leave the B spin alone. And one nice way of doing this is to give a 90-degree rotation to both of them, let's say about the y-axis. So then they would both be rotated into the x-axis. Then we could wait for some time. And we wait for a time such that they're separated by 90 degrees, right? They have different frequencies, so it's easy, right? We wait for a time that says omega A minus omega B is equal times time is equal to pi over 2. And if I have this situation and I want A to be in a coherent superposition, then it's trivial. I give a 90-degree pulse, but I do it along the axis that A is sitting at, so that A is not rotated, right? It commutes with that. So then we go and give a 90-degree pulse. We're still rotating A and B, but I'm doing this along the phase of A, so A is fixed. And so now I've created a coherent superposition of A, and B is along Z, right where it started. and everything's good. And, you know, you could each come up with a dozen ways of doing this experiment. The point I want to make is here. When one says that we need a gate which is fast compared to decoherence, well, you'll often find people say, oh, well, I have this velocity, which is 100 megahertz. My decoherence time, T2, from there, is of order 10 seconds. So I can multiply those two together, calculate the number of gates, and I can say, oh, this is great. I can have 10 to the 9 gates. But if I want to do this gate, well, this gate doesn't depend upon this. It depends upon the chemical shift difference, right? And so now I can't do that many gates because I have to wait. We're going to get our selectivity based upon this frequency, not the 100 megahertz. Yeah? Okay. Good. So now then, So it depends upon what gate. And we're going to come back to that because it'll depend upon what gate some more. But now let's look at the initialization. So if I want to initialize, and let me introduce two idempotents. Right, so those are the projectors of Z. And of course, E plus minus squared is equal to E plus minus. And E plus E minus is equal to zero, right? So what I'd like to do is I'd like to have my initial density matrix be of that form, that the two spins are polarized. And you've noticed throughout the lectures of the last week that I tend to drop the identity. And the reason is, of course, that we're looking at the deviation from the identity, and that deviation is 10 to the minus 5. And 10 to the minus 5 is a depressing number. So we don't want to keep repeating that over and over again. But in this case, we better keep track of that, right? So this is what I want. And if we expand it out, we'll see that it looks like this in terms of the spin operators. And if I take the equilibrium density matrix, well, the equilibrium density matrix says that I have the identity minus epsilon sigma z over 2. And of course, that's tensored with the same thing. And therefore, this is equal to this is of order 10 to the minus 5. Now, that epsilon squared term, we can pretty much throw away. And not only because it's small, but also because it's a counting term. What it says is that if I reached in and pulled out one spin, and then I reached in and I pulled out another one, that they would be correlated to this amount epsilon squared. But that correlation didn't tie them to a molecule, right? That's just over the whole ensemble. And so, and this piece, it's only ever going to do us good if it's in a molecule, right? Because I can only control the spins if they're in the same molecule. So then we keep this piece here. And now then, we're a long, long, long way away from that. But we can create a state which transforms as a pure state . Now I'm going to do this clearly. If I take this density matrix, I'm going to say it's approximately right, it's approximately the sum of this. Clearly, I can't take this and transform it into that, even if I drop the identity, right? They have a different eigenstructure. And so I won't be able to reach that unitarily. But I can reach it on average over a set of operations. So if I take sigma ZA plus sigma ZB, I can certainly do nothing and get sigma ZA plus sigma ZB. And if I take sigma ZA and I apply a pi over 2 rotation about y, then here I would have a state that the A spins now are aligned along the x-axis. But of course, there's two types of A spins. There's the A spins with the B spin pointing up and the A spin with the B spin pointing down. And they're equally likely, right? That's what this is telling us. They're equally likely. So we have two states. And if I allow them to evolve under the sigma z interaction, then the state that's coupled to the B spin up will rotate in one direction, and the state that's coupled to the B spin down will rotate in the other direction, and we'll correlate the two states. And so at some perfect time later, we'll have this state which has no detectable magnetization, but it has a perfect correlation between the A and B spins. And if I rotate this by a pi over 2 pulse about this direction, the x direction, then I would rotate that into the operator sigma z a times sigma z b. So if I take my equilibrium density matrix and I run two experiments and I add the results, then I would have created a state which, other than the identity part, looks like this, like the pure state. And the identity part isn't detectable, right? We're detecting m sub x. And so here, for all apparent measurements, we would have a state that we can explore the dynamics of pure state structures. Okay. Now, it's all, from this point on, it's all apparent unitary dynamics that we're interested in. But we can create a state, and it's called a pseudo-pure state. And notice that it took two operations. And then if I said, oh, well, allow me to put three. And then you would say, well, how many terms will I get here? Okay, so now I get eight terms. And then you say, well, allow me to get four. Then we get 16 terms. And so the number of experiments I would have to do to create this pseudo-pure state scales poorly. Scales is exponentially in the number of qubits. So it's, you know, there's nothing good about it, except it allows us to make a quantum processor which will behave like a quantum computer, but will not scale like a quantum computer. Yeah? Now, it turns out, I don't want to belabor this too much, there's actually lots and lots of ways of polarizing spins. So if it was really just a question that I needed to polarize spins to have a quantum computer, that's easy. This problem up here, we don't get away with. So when I think about why I'm not using liquid state NMR to build a quantum computer, it's not this problem, although I would have to fix it. It's been fixed. It's this problem. Okay. So now then, we have our system that has a pseudo-pure state. It's not going to allow us to reach the efficiencies of doing quantum error correction, or of using it for teleportation, or of using it for algorithmic cooling. But we can use it to investigate all the elements of control necessary for all those experiments. Good. All right. And here, notice that at this point, I had to use this term in the Hamiltonian. And that's the slowest term. That term is only some hertz. And so then we'd say, oh yes, if I want to have a conditional gate, then I could maybe have 20 or 100 conditional gates. You know, if I only wanted to do an unconditional rotation of the whole processor, I can do 10 to the 9 of them. Yeah, but if I want a conditional gate, well, then you can't do so many. All right. Now I want to turn to creating a controlled NOT gate. You know, we have this idea that if we want to have universal control, we should have a controlled NOT gate or a Toffoli gate or a Fredkin gate. But let's just go through it with the controlled NOT gate because it's non-trivial enough that it's interesting to look at. And trivial enough that we don't have to spend that long looking at it. And I don't know if Andrew or Joseph showed you that, or you've seen it before. No? Okay. So it's a useful little result. It's true in the case that A commutes with the eigenpotence. And it's nice and easy to show. So if I take, let's just take one of the two eigenpoints. They'll, of course, not be any different for the others. And we just expand it, right? And so now if I go ahead and expand this for the n equals 0 term, and then the rest are, I could try writing them correctly. And of course, here, we can nicely take advantage of this being an idempotent. And so now then, I can pull out E plus. But I want to do one more thing. I want to take, I didn't show it over here. But of course, the sum of those two idempotents is the identity operator. So if I write this as the sum of those two, and I pluck E plus out of this, then I've proven what I wanted to do. Good. So let's take our unitary, which is sigma x. So if I want to have a controlled NOT gate, then a controlled NOT gate says rotate the A spin conditional on the B spin, right? So if the B spin is pointing down, I'll rotate the A spin. If the B spin is pointing up, I'll leave it alone. And of course, if you're writing out the propagators for these, you have to write it out in this way, that you have to specify all possible states and what would happen. Okay, so there's our unitary, there's our unitary. And I'm going to factor it so that I can apply this rule, right? So I want things to look like I have that structure. And the factoring that I like, and the problem with coming up with gates is that there's an infinite number of gates that do the same thing, of course. Okay, so we can factor it this way. And you know, it's a little bit, all the cross terms, of course, are going to go to zero. So I can use the fact that all the cross terms are going to go to zero to make this nicely into a configuration that I want, because then I can say, well, this thing here is e to the minus I sigma x a e minus b pi over 2. And this piece is e to the I, e minus b, identity a, pi over 2. Okay? And then, since we're running out of time, maybe I leave the rest for homework. If you take these terms and you expand them back into the poly basis, Because really, I want to get the gates to look like the gates I've shown you over here. Okay? Then you'll end up with four terms. And this I'll write out quickly. E to the minus I. It's useful to convince yourself that these all commute, so we're free to do anything we like with them. This piece looks easy, right? It's a pi over 2 rotation about the x-axis for the A spin. We've already shown how to do that. That's a global phase. Doesn't mean that you should forget it. You know, if this is the size of your Hilbert space, you can forget it. If this is embedded in a larger Hilbert space, you should pay attention to it. And this is a Z rotation of the B spin. So we haven't talked about how to get a Z rotation. But, you know, one way is to just wait and turn off the scalar coupling. One way is, although it's a bit funky, is to take your electronics and rotate them by 90 degrees figuratively. Another way is to say, if I want a Z rotation, then I can take a pi over 2 rotation about x, and I can sandwich that with rotations about y, so I have a similarity transform that takes x to z. And of course, here we have xz rotation, and what the Hamiltonian gives us is a zz rotation, but we just said how to convert that to a zz rotation. So you can put it all together. You can spit out a pulse sequence from this. And this is easy to automate. And so you can drive from this all the gates for any unitary. You can do it easily. All right. So what have we said? We've said that here we can look through De Vincenzo's requirements. A qubit specific measurement, that's easy. We can measure sigma x. Universal set of gates, that's easy. Gates fast compared to the decoherence time, Initialize, not in your life, you know, scalable. Bloody hell. But it still is the system that has shown the most in the biggest Hilbert spaces so far. And we'll show you in a couple lectures how to fit that all together. Okay? So let me stop here. Any questions? Okay.